what you're known for, right? So this question sets up who you are and what you're known for now. And I basically want to find out what your business is like. Who do you serve? What do you do for them?
We were in the live entertainment industry. We were in the auto industry, advertising and marketing, those things, anywhere from a monster truck show all the way to doing a camping. But what I'm known for and what we're known for is solving big problems. The one thing that we do is we listen to the clients, and everybody says they do that, but they don't. Because what they do is they've got a set skill set inside their building, typically. Advertising and marketing agencies will have a graphic artist, they'll have a creative director, they'll have somebody that works with video. But those people are, their skill sets are locked into their capabilities. And so what we do is we listen to what the client really wants to do, and then we figure out with their budget how to make that happen. But utilizing top line people, not just the people that are available. Our business is modeled more after the film industry than it is an advertising agency. So we build teams that fit the client's needs, as opposed to taking our people and trying to fit them, you know, their square peg into the client's round hole. The square peg into the round hole, yeah.
Are an inspiring group of people. Every one of them, from the larger-than-life comic book heroes you see on the big silver screen, the everyday heroes that let us live the privileged lives we do. Every hero has a story to tell, from the doctor saving lives at your local hospital, to the war veteran down the street who risked his life for our freedom, to the police officers and the firefighters who risk their safety to ensure ours. Every hero is special and every story worth telling. But there is one class of heroes that I think is often ignored. The entrepreneur, the creator, the producer. The ones who look at the problems in this world and think to themselves, you know what, I can fix that. I can help people. I can make a difference. Then they go out and do exactly that by creating a new product or introducing a new service. Some go on to change the world. Others make a world of difference to their customers. Welcome to the Hero Show. Join us as we pull back the masks on the world's finest heropreneurs and learn the secrets to their powers, their success, and their influence, so you can use those secrets to attract more sales, make more money, and experience more freedom in your business. I'm your host, Richard Matthews, and we are on in 3, 2, 1.
Hello and welcome back to The Hero Show. My name is Richard Matthews. Today I have the pleasure of having on the line Tim Kramer. Tim, are you there?
I am here.
Awesome. Glad to have you here, Tim.
Are you?
So what I would, before we get too far into the interview here, I always start off with a brief introduction for our audience. So Tim Kramer is 58 years old, began his career in broadcasting at the age of 16. When he turned 35, he founded Mosaic, an advertising and production house based in Indianapolis, Indiana, and you work exclusively with conservative brands and candidates and causes. Mm-hmm. And so that's a very brief introduction, but what I want to start off with is what you're known for, right? So this question sets up who you are and what you're known for now. And I basically want to find out what your business is like. Who do you serve? What do you do for them?
Well, for the longest time, up until COVID, we were in the live entertainment industry. We were in the auto industry, advertising and marketing, those things, anywhere from a monster truck show all the way to doing a camping show. For example, you know, the latest camping gear and that kind of stuff, those kind of events. We were really heavy into that going into COVID, as well as politics. And starting in 2020, it was a real struggle because the live industry got decimated by COVID restrictions. And so we saw one after another of our clients we'd worked with for 25 to 30 years just fall by the wayside. They folded up shop and went away. So it's been a struggle through that. But what I'm known for and what we're known for is solving big problems. The one thing that we do is we listen to the clients, and everybody says they do that, but they don't, because what they do is they've got a set skill set inside their building, typically. Advertising and marketing agencies will have a graphic artist, they'll have a creative director, they'll have somebody that works with video, but those people are, their skill sets are locked into their capabilities. And so what we do is we listen to what the client really wants to do, and then we figure out with their budget how to make that happen. But utilizing top line people, not just the people that are available. Our business is modeled more after the film industry than it is an advertising agency. So we build teams that fit the client's needs, as opposed to taking our people and trying to fit them, you know, their square peg into the client's round hole. The square peg into the round hole, yeah.
Yeah, so you're basically trying to like hire the talent, right? That's going to come in and be a part of the production or be part of the process.
Well, more specifically, is that the example I always give is that years ago we had a 3D artist in house, and they were good. They were really good at what they did, but they had limitations. Their forte was not character animation. They were more of an architectural designer as opposed to creating, you know, fluffy characters like Disney or Pixar. And when we needed that service, well, we had to go out and find it anyway. And this person that was in this chair sitting there, as good as they were, costing us anywhere from $80,000 to $100,000 a year for that person and their training and their capabilities. And we realized that we were spending a lot of money on hiring out other people because of the limitations within home. And so what we did is we decided to remedy that by, when that person left, we didn't rehire in that position. What we would do is we would go find the Pixar artist for those projects, somebody who's freelancing or has a small business they've just started themselves, and we utilize them as a contractor, as opposed to having an employee. And what we found is it solved a number of problems for us. First of all, the vacation issue. There's nothing worse than starting a big project and you've got a client who has an emergency. They've got to get something, you know, going immediately. And the person that you're going to rely on to do that is gone for a week to 2 weeks. And so by working with contractors, we alleviate that problem right off the bat, because these contractors are locked into the dates that we've stated in our deal of what we need and the timelines that we need certain projects finished by, started by, or at least the milestone of what your first ideas, present those, then go on vacation while we're talking about that. But that really alleviated that problem for us. The biggest thing that it did for us, though, is it allowed us to have the best talent available for the project that we were working on, as opposed to trying to force one of our guys that highly trained, really good, just didn't fit it. I liken it to a voiceover artist. I do voice work all the time, but I'm not the fit. I do not work for clients who want a soft, nice, you know, that's just not, I can't do it. It sounds like I'm faking it and I'm not believable. So I don't use me in that instance when we're going to do voice work. And it's the same way with any other artistic or creative endeavors, that you've got to utilize the right people for their job. A great example would be if Steven Spielberg called me tomorrow and said, "Hey, I need you to do these special effects for this film I've got." I'm not qualified. I can get so close, but I cannot get what he wants. So that's what we've solved. And that's just one of the measures we've taken over the last 30 years. We're a different animal than most agencies.
Yeah, that makes sense. And to your point, you do have the wonderful voice. Sounds like you could do that like in a world, you know.
That's what I get teased with all the time. Can you do that for me?
Really? So I want to talk about your origin story, right? Every good comic book hero has an origin story. It's the thing that made them into the hero they are today. But we want to hear that story. Were you born a hero? Were you bit by a radioactive spider that made you want to get into advertising and eventually into political commentary? Or did you start in a job and eventually move to become an entrepreneur? Basically, how did you get here?
I'm going to be real vain here for a moment. I got tired of being the smartest person in the room without the ability to do anything about it. And I know that sounds egotistical, but it's not. What I realized is that the way that I think is different than a lot of people, and it allows me to see things from different points of view and then, you know, make my determination based on that. And I kept working for great companies. And I'd get up to a certain point and then stall. I couldn't go any further. And I got tired of it. And I saw a better way of doing things, more efficient way of doing things. And one of the things that I fought was, we've always done it this way, right? Yeah, there's no reason to change, Kramer. Why rock the boat? We've always done it this way. I was working, and this is before I got into broadcasting. I worked for a small company. And they printed checks. It was Deluxe Check Printers. They were a printing company. You probably get your checks from Deluxe. There's only a couple companies in the whole nation that do it. So if you write checks, you probably got one that I had my hands on in the early 80s. But they had a sorting process. So to make the checks, you had to sort in a certain way and pull the checks. You had to put a sheet on top, and then you had your checks. You had your balance pieces of paper. You know, what's it called? The deposit slips. Right? All the things that had to go into your checkbook had to be pulled individually from this stock that we had. And the way that they had it set up was they were pulling from the bottom. And so what that meant was, is that you started at the bottom. It made sense that you were starting at the bottom and you'd pull the paper out. And then every time you pulled any additional paper out, the first initial page you put out was in way. And everybody was doing it that way. And I stacked my bin from the top down to sort from the top down. And it made it substantially faster. And we were paid a project fee, meaning that I had to get 2 pallets a day done, and then I was done. I didn't work a 4 or 8 hour shift. When my pallets were done, that's what I got paid for. So in my mind, I wanted to get those pallets done as fast as possible, the most efficient way possible. And I broke the rules that everybody else was doing to do that. And when they found out that I was about 38% faster by doing it this way, everyone went to that because they were getting paid for the project. That's one of the things that I look at and our company does, even in advertising. We come into a company and we look at what they're doing across the board, not just what they want to accomplish, but what they're how they're doing it and how we're delivered assets. And for example, we go into companies and many times I'll say, well, can you get me your style guide, your color palette? Can you get me your mission statement? They don't have it all together. They don't have it in one place. Well, that's a big problem for a marketing department not to have those assets available. Where's your logo? If you get a call from somebody, you're in the news and you want to get a logo to somebody easily, how do you do that? Well, what we do is we streamline those types of things to get the busy work out of your day done. What we found is that a lot of agencies, well, they would just go back to the client's files and they would pull those logos and send them via email. Very time consuming. What we did is for our clients, when we start a new project, we create on their website a media page that's password protected that allows not only all the members of their team, but all the members of our team, if they're on the road or elsewhere, to have access to these assets. It's simple thinking like that so that we're not going back time and time again, asking for the same things over and over again. And they're not delivering the same things over and over again. We get those mundane things out by creating efficiencies. Yes, it takes a couple of hours to get that done up front, but there's no longer any 5-minute jobs. All you say is, hey, if you want the logos, if you want our media package, if you want this or that, it's on the website. Here's the password. I'll send you that. And they've got access to everything. And it's that kind of thinking. And that's at the lowest level, right? We worked with a client one time, actually it was just a few months ago, that they had a project that they wanted to initiate and they were a national sales approach for a new product. And when they launched it, right? Well, I shouldn't say when they launched it, we got it fixed, but they had not thought about the fact of working on a national level. They had always worked at a regional level. And I said, well, when you go to a national level, it's much larger. The impact is much larger. Will the infrastructure of your order taking be able to sustain that? Oh, yeah, it should be able to do it. Well, should is not good enough for me, right? Because if it fails, our company, because we're the outsiders, right, are the ones that get blamed for it. And so I want to make sure that we're going to be successful all the way through so that if we're not going to hire the people that we need today to take those orders, is there a system in place to ramp up easily or ramp up quickly? And I understand cost saving, but the worst thing to have is a client who's trying to make an order of your product and they can't get through. So these are, again, some of the things that we work on that are outside of what an advertising agency usually does, but we look at the logistics because we've had these problems before. So we try to solve those problems up front by saying, here's all the issues that we've seen creep up. And are you thinking about this? And having an advocate for you that's thinking outside the box and looking at things that you don't know. I think that there's a politician one time that said we'd the unknown unknowns. And I'm a firm believer in that. I don't believe that we know everything. And so since we don't know everything, right, we have to assume that there are some things we don't know. And we've got people outside that are looking in. Their voices are important if they have information that we don't. And so that's what we try to provide to our clients is that we work in such a wide array of clients that we've just about over the last 30 years seen everything. And so our biggest push for our client is to help make them successful. I've said time and time again that when we come on board, we're a vested partner. I know everybody says that, but we really believe that. Our very first client was our client for 30 years. The only thing that killed them was COVID. They were with our very first client. That's uncommon to have a client for 30 years. We're all still friends. We all still get together and, you know, and have conversation, have a drink or whatever. But the business end of it has changed. What we tried to do in that relationship is we got to the point where we had almost 100% autonomy in the marketing and the messaging that we were doing for the client. We'd gotten to know them so well. We understood what their ideology was and their corporate culture was so well that we were able to act as them, even though we were completely independent.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so you've been all over the place over the last 30 years with your company. And it sounds like efficiency has been just a strong drive through what you do. It's funny, you're talking about the media page. It's something we actually do with our company as well. It's like we have a media page that has like our whole brand style guide and all of our logos, right, all of our colors and all the things on it. And when people ask for it, here it is. And it's one of the things that like every client that we work with, if they don't have that page, it's one of the things that we just like value add. Be like, hey, we're going to set this up for
exactly.
you in the future.
Because it's easier for you, right? At the end of the day, it's easier for everybody. And it just makes sense.
Yeah, makes everyone's life better. And it also surprises me because I said, you're in an advertising agency. We're in a podcasting agency. But so like, we're like generally second or third down the line from like the person who's helping them set up their brand and their style and all that kind of stuff. We'll ask them, be like, okay, hey, we're ready to help you build this stuff. Do you have your brand style guide? 90% of the clients be like, we don't have a brand style guide. Like,
exactly.
How did you get to this point?
Exactly. Well, and that's what advertising agencies do. I'm working with a congressional campaign right now, and their signs had one look, their buttons had another look. Their billboards had another look. They had a color palette that they had chosen, but it wasn't complementary to each other, right? In marketing, you need high contrast generally to get the message out. And all of their colors were, they all blended together, and it didn't, there was nothing that allowed any of the messaging in text to pop out on the screen or to pop out on the page. And so the first thing we came in and did was we cleaned that up before we could redesign everything. And not to put our fingerprint on it, but to put the best foot forward for the client. They had a billboard, for example, that you had to be up on the billboard before you could read it. Well, everybody knows that by the time you're on a billboard, it's too late to read it. There was too much being said. They wanted to include everything. They wanted their mission statement on there. They wanted their website on there. They were mandated by government that they had to have the FEC paid for. That's got to go on there. And it's got stipulations on how big it has to be. So before we knew it, the entire sign was taken over and it wasn't being effective. They were trying to say too much. And my thing is that, especially with a billboard, is that you've got 4 to 5 seconds to make one point. And fighting with clients, well, I really need to have this up there. If you put this up there, it makes the entire sign ineffective because there's too much to read. The human mind going 70, 80 miles an hour cannot pull all that in. Here's something else for people out there. This is a known fact within inside the advertising industry. If you're using billboards, they're for directions. You better have a very concise next interchange marketing plan for billboards, unless it's a broad statement. If you're advertising Budweiser beer, that's one thing. If you're advertising Fruit of the Loom underwear, that's one thing. But if you're advertising a service with a phone number and a website and your mission statement or who you are on that billboard, you've missed it. Nobody ever writes down a phone number from a billboard. They just don't, right? Yeah. There's no reason to do that. Websites are better.
This exit now kind of thing is what billboards are most useful
exactly.
for.
Exactly. That's what they're, coming up next within the next 2 miles. And that's the way that we try. Again, we look at some projects or some mediums as they're ego-based, right? I've got a client, he's an attorney. He likes to see his face on the billboards. Well, you put up a billboard with my face on it. How will anybody know? If your name isn't enough, your face ain't going to do it. Right. If the message isn't strong enough, if we haven't hit it with the message that we put up there, your face has nothing to do with the message. And so we finally broke them of that. They've now realized that if the message is effective, that the face doesn't need to be there. Exactly. And the analogy I used was you don't see Ronald McDonald's face everywhere. You see a McDonald's sign.
Yeah.
It's just part of the brand. It's not the entire brand. And so it's kind of looking at things through a different viewpoint and how people actually use it. I think that you asked what one of my superpowers was, is understanding how humans work, why they do what they do. We look at purchases that we make in our lives and we go, well, I saw a TV ad and I decided to get that. Well, the TV ad was just advising you that this product is available. You at some point made the emotional decision to take your hard-earned money, whatever this product is, and go spend it on that versus something else. That's an emotional decision. And so knowing how humans work emotionally in their purchasing, also that comes into play in the process of trying to convince, because we're selling as well, we're selling an idea to a client, that persuasion and understanding how people look at things is important. We had a client years ago that had a logo that was terrible. You couldn't read it. You couldn't see it. On the side of their vehicles they had, it was a circle with all the names of what they did. It was ugly. It did not say who they were. And it didn't mean anything. So we go into a meeting. We were asked by the marketing director to redesign the entire logo. We did. It was much clearer to see. It had a message behind it. The previous logo had certain things in it for certain reasons. We included all those in the new design. And when we went to present it, what we didn't understand was the ego that was in the room, the emotion that was in the room, because two of the board members had been instrumental in designing that logo. We didn't know that. So, we go in and step on a lot of toes real fast. But at the end of the day, they realized that what we showed them was, here's your logo at 100 feet. Here's your logo at 100 yards. Here's your logo at a mile. Can you determine what your logo is at these distances? No. Well, if you're waiting for somebody to get up on this vehicle, because it was a Mid-America Clinical Labs was the name of the company. And I said, if you're waiting for them to get up on your vehicle to be able to read who you are, it's too late. You've lost the opportunity. And once we showcased it, they lost the ego part of it, but they really wanted the other one because they put their thumbprint on it. And that's what we find a lot of times is the hardest part for an ad agency to do is to come in and kind of break the corporate culture, right? And say, yeah, you've been successful here, but we can help you be more successful if you'll change these minor things or if you'll do it this way. And it's been real successful over the last 30 years, up until COVID. When COVID happened, that was a game changer for the industry. But what we found is that these methodologies work. And you said, you know, earlier, the key to being efficient, the real reason that I'm efficient is I'm lazy, Richard. That's really what it comes down to. I'm just lazy. So I try to find the most efficient ways to get things done, to make the most amount of money for me and my clients, but as well, be able to make the biggest impact with the dollars that are being spent.
Yeah, I know, like just speaking about the all the stuff that you're putting into the marketplace, whether it's a billboard or the logo or whatever, or the colors, and you talked about, you know, like the color palettes being different and different things. I've always talked about that as being like the unconscious trust signals in the market.
Right.
And unconscious trust signals are basically just, they're the things that like your audience is seeing all of this stuff, and they may not be able to put their finger on why they don't trust you. But if everything they see from you looks a little bit different, has a different brand, and has a different, like, you know, different fonts are being used in different ways and different colors are being used in different ways, or that your logo doesn't make sense to them, that's, it's an unconscious trust signal where they're just like, they're like, I don't trust that company, and they're not going to do business with you. And like I said, they, if you were to line them all up and ask them, do you know why you trust this company, not this one? They probably couldn't give you the specifics about what's happening with the brand like you or I could, but what's happening. And so that's where like your superpower you're talking about, you understand that. You understand what's happening in their head, even though they don't.
Right, exactly. Well, because when you have something you've done, imagine you've got a five-year-old that brings you a picture, right? And the first thing you do with that child, right? Oh, that is so good. Because there's no expectations of greatness, right? But everyone who's an adult thinks they're great and that their ideas are unquestionable. I've gotten to this position because of my ability to make good decisions. I go back to what I said about Steven Spielberg. It would be a bad decision for him to hire me to do his special effects work. It just would. Yeah. I can work inside those fields. I can work within After Effects. I can work inside the applications, but my skill set is lacking. And so for me to come in, I can come in and say, well, we got to fix those things. We got to hire somebody that's really good at doing it. And I've got to persuade this person that their ideas went to a certain point and now we're going to polish them all, right? We're going to put the shine on them. And a lot of time I call it the sizzle, that, you know, the sizzle of what your idea is not really there yet. And what we're going to do is make it to where it gets exciting, right? It's the difference between coming out on a stage and saying, okay, the play starts in 5 minutes, or coming out and someone saying, the greatest play in humankind is next. Get in your seats. You see what I'm saying? It's a different presentation and expectation. And to your point about brand, the reason that people align with a brand is because it delivers on the promises that it made at a cost that they can absorb. That's all it is. And that they want to be able to rely on that brand continuously. And when a client sidesteps the brand and does something different than the client is expecting, then they feel, well, Coca-Cola was a great example. When they went to the new Coke, they changed the brand. They changed what people expected. They didn't like it. They didn't want it. And so they spoke out. And what happened? Again, it happened with Bud Light here just a few months ago, different deal, but they messed with the brand. And people said, no, we don't. It cost them, you know, billions of dollars for that mistake. That's what we try to stop companies from doing, is making those errors in just the little things. And if you do it in the little things, Richard, it doesn't happen with the big things.
Yeah, right.
It just doesn't.
It's getting all the small things right, which is why, you know, I'll talk to my clients about little things like, hey, you know, and this is something you probably know, but like when you do font selection, right, you generally have like a headline font and a body font, and it's like real baseline stuff in it for a graphic designer, but they talk about making the fonts age well, right? So the A, G, and E match, right, for between the two things. It makes a lot of sense to someone like us, right, who's in this world, but it's like those little things that are you paying attention to the little stuff all the way through and then consistently applying it across your brand, whether that's your messaging, your imaging, or wherever it is, it really has just a huge impact on the perception of your brand in the marketplace.
Right, exactly.
So I want to switch gears a little bit. We talked a little bit about your origin story and your superpowers. I'm going to talk about the flip side of your superpower, which is the fatal flaw, right? So just like every Superman has his kryptonite, or Wonder Woman can't remove her bracelets of victory without going mad, you probably have something you struggled with, something that's held you back. And for me, it was a couple of things. I struggled with perfectionism for a long time, still do a little bit. Also having a poor relationship with self-care. So things like not having good boundaries with my clients, or staying up too late and working instead of sleeping, that kind of stuff. And those kind of things have always held me back, and I've always worked on fixing those. But for you, what are some of your fatal flaws that you've worked on? I think more important than what they are is how have you worked to overcome them so you can continue to grow your
business? I don't know if I've overcome them, Richard. They're still flaws. My biggest one is those who don't recognize what's right in front of them. There is an opportunity available, or there's a hurdle available, and you're trying to warn them, or you're trying to, hey, guys, I got a great example. We've got this solar eclipse deal happening in April. We've got a client who wanted to do something with it. And there was a point where we went in, and I just, in a meeting, I just said, listen, I said, either piss or get off the pot. Either we're going to do this or we're not. That's my fatal flaw. Because what I see is that we were discussing it for 6 weeks, discussing it.
Yeah.
Now we're 6 weeks out. If we want to do anything, we are at the cusp. There's nothing we can do. There's a deadline that we meet in effectiveness of marketing. You can't spend $1 million the day before the event and then say, well, it was unsuccessful. Yeah. No, you had to have 6 to 8 weeks. You got to let people know that it's there. They got to talk to their friends. They got to say, hey, do you want to go? They make plans about it, right? You sell the sizzle of what's going to be there. Is it going to be a concert there? Is there going to be entertainers there? Is there going to be face painting for the kids? Will you get free glasses, right? Is there free food? What's being supplied? What's the sizzle of this event? And you sell that and people get emotionally involved. Oh, I want to see the sun, you know, go by. I want to see the moon go in front of the sun. I want to be able to look at it directly. I'm going to get myself a pair of free glasses and a free hot dog. But you got to let them know 6 weeks to 8 weeks prior. And if you're waiting, that's my flaw. That's where I have, it just irks me that, because that now we have no efficiencies. We have no time to be able to be really good. Now we're scrambling. Now, with that being said, the way that we work with our clients is that I use the, you know, the 2-3 rule, right? It can be good. It can be fast. It can be cheap. You pick two. Which one do you want?
The closer
we get to a deadline, Richard, the closer we get to a deadline, the more expensive it becomes.
Yeah.
And the less good it becomes.
Yeah. We talk about that all the time in our company. We call that the iron triangle, you know, better, cheaper, faster, pick two. So anyways, yeah, that's definitely a thing that you have to deal with a lot with clients. And so you're saying the flaw is that how it irks you, and does that like show up in how you interact with the clients?
Yeah. Yeah. It's frustration, right? Because they're not the only client that we're dealing with. They're not the only one that we're juggling. So we've got other clients that are going through the exact same kind of deals. And when we say, listen, it's going to take 3 weeks to get this website up and running. It doesn't take 3 weeks to create a website. Everybody knows that today with these template-based systems, you can have a website up and running within 24 hours, right? Everything's running. Everything's doing what it's supposed to do. But it takes time to write the content. It takes time to find the right imagery. It takes time to make it look right. It goes through the revision process. It goes through the rewriting process. There's a whole, and if you're depending on what industry you're in, it may have to go back through legal again.
Yeah.
So we need that 6 to 8 weeks. I'm running for office, political office. I built my own website and had the whole thing done in 6 hours. But that's because I was writing it all. I knew what images I wanted to use. I knew how I wanted it to look and appeal. And so I was able to do that in 6 hours. And it's a great site. By the way, if you want to help me, you can go to isupportkramer.com and make a donation. But that's the approach that we've gone through with our clients. And I'm, for lack of a better term, a hard ass about it. I worked at a radio station that had very weak rules on when they could get copy into the station. And so it was very common for the salespeople to come in at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and say, hey, I sold this deal. Can you get this on the air today? And you go, well, it's 5 o'clock. I'm leaving in 20 minutes. Well, can you do it? And then, no, I'm not doing it. No, because the rule is you're supposed to have it in by 2 o'clock so that we have time to get it done right. Now I'm rushing. I want to get home to my family. And so am I likely to put my best energy forward in doing this? No. Now I'm mad at you because you've made me stay. The next time you walk into my office, we're going to have a problem because I assume that you're going to try and abuse me again and think that I'm going to do everything that you promised. And that's one of the things I went into the sales meeting and I said, listen, I said, your promises don't have any bearing on what my timeline is. You promised a client something and you don't know if that's possible today. That's on you. You've got to call that client and say, I misspoke. I didn't know. They're busier than I thought. So what we did at the station, it was in Indianapolis, WZPL. I was there for 7 years. It was the last radio job that I had full time. And I went in there and cleaned up that department. And in the 7 years that I was there, we missed 2 commercials. That was production's problem. It was our fault. We missed it. I screwed something up, or one of my assistants screwed something up, and we had to eat it. And the way that I sold this to the station was, as I said, make me and my department beneficiaries of doing it right. Not just a job. You're passing millions of dollars through here. We're ultimately responsible. We hold it at the very last minute. If it's going to screw up, it's going to screw up through us. So give us an incentive not to do that. So my department got incentivized. We got a percentage of all the spots that cleared through the station. And if we screwed something up and it cost the station money, then those dollars were taken back out of that fund and given back to the station. Well, people don't like to lose money. So guess what we got? We got really good at not screwing up.
That reminds me of, I tell people all the time, that it's like, if you're not getting the results that you want, check the incentive structures.
Exactly.
Because like if you're running a company, it doesn't matter what you're doing, always check the incentive structures. And my favorite example in my history was I worked for a solar company and I was the CMO and I was working with the president of sales. And they were talking about like the biggest problem they were having was there's a lot of competition in the solar space. And so like people shop their solar provider. And I was like, how about we just change the game and change the incentive structure? Because what was happening is the incentive structure for the salesperson was you get a point on the total, like, what do you call it? The total cost of the system. And what everyone in the industry was doing. So all the salespeople were coming in there with the biggest solar system they could fit on your roof. And there's between the what they were doing. So I was like, what we had the sales guys do is we had all of our engineers train all the salespeople on how to build an efficient system and a whole house system. Yeah. And so then we would tell all of the clients basically, like, hey, if you're going to come in, I know you're going to shop them all around, shop them all in, have us come in last so we can explain how they all work to you and we will build an efficient system for you. And so what we trained them to do was essentially do a lighting retrofit, an LED lighting retrofit, and do a whole house fan retrofit, and do a, you know, a variable speed pool pump retrofit. And then with the cost of the energy reduced, then build the solar system on top of it, which would the savings in the difference between doing those and the retrofits would generally pay for all the other retrofits. So they'd be getting four or five different retrofit, a smaller system, and still be saving like $10,000 or $20,000 depending on the size of the house. And so when we would show that to our to the clients, we would win every single time, right? We would win all those
because it was the solution instead of a sale.
Yeah,
right?
And we started doing incentivizing the salespeople, not on the size of the system, but on the efficiency of the system instead. And so if they had a highly efficient system, they would get the points on the sale. And that it changed the game. We 10x their lead flow through the company over the next 15 months because of that.
Right. And that's our approach, is that we had a client years ago. And again, it's looking at the industry. It's the industry, you know, fairly standard. I went in to pitch this company. It was a metal hardening company in Indianapolis. And they were expanding nationally. They'd been working regionally and they decided to go national. And so we go to help them launch. And the initial thing that they wanted, Richard, they only wanted a website. That's all they wanted. Just a website. If we got the website, then, and they had a marketing person in-house, but if we get the website, then we can take on this market. And I was, again, I was the last guy to come in. And when we talked, I'm real blunt. I don't blow smoke up clients' butts. I'm not trying to impress them. I want to help them while making money. That's it. That's all it is. There's no, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm trying to think the best word to use for it. We're not there to, I'll be blunt. We're there to make money. That's it. Bottom line. There to make money for everybody, right? We're going to make a percentage of what they make from what we're doing. We're going to help them get their stuff streamlined, their material streamlined, their look and feel streamlined. But when I come into these meetings, I'm very blunt about what the mission is. And so when I talk to the CEO of this company, and I said, well, what's your growth potential? Where do you think you can go? And this is, again, this is in 2019. So the sky was the limit. We sat down with them. It was a 20-minute, 30-minute interview. They had talked to several other vendors. And we were the only ones asking beyond the website. How are you going to market this? How are you going to get the message out? And what do you want to say? And how do you want to be perceived by the marketplace? Who are you? What capabilities do you have over the guy next door? And they didn't know any of that. And the marketing director didn't know any of that. And so I said, you don't need a website yet. What you need is you need to have your brand defined. That will tell you what your website is supposed to be. Not just your website, but all of your marketing material, all the collateral, everything. And so they allowed us to do what we do, and they gave us a substantial budget because it was a very short time. It was very compressed, but they gave us a substantial budget to get a number of things done. They had no corporate photography. They had no headshots of their staff or their C-level. They had no history or no story as to who these people were. And these guys are, they're metallurgists, right? They're top-end engineers. They look at the metal and not just what the metal is on the outside, but they cut it in half. They look at the crystalline structure on the interior of it. When you go to the heat treating process, and this is another thing that we do, we jump into the industry. We didn't know anything about the heat treat industry at all. But when you jump into it and find out what's going on, then you can find out, well, they're not really different from this industry over here. And this industry, this is how we did it because this is what worked best. So they're high-end manufacturing. They sell only to high-end clients. They're marketing to NASA. They're marketing to, what's Elon Musk's group, SpaceX. Yeah. GM is a large client of theirs. So we're not going to market through, you know, doing a commercial on MTV, on cable, or on Fox News, or on CNN. That's not going to be effective for this market. And so we have to build all of the pieces together and think of it as a big, big puzzle that we're putting together, as opposed to saying, we need a website and that'll get us going. Before that was apps. Everybody was having us build apps. And my first question was, what's it supposed to accomplish? How will we know if we're successful? We build this for you and it's a flop. It doesn't take off. Who gets blamed?
Yeah, you guys, right?
They're like, right, we did, because we're the outsiders. They didn't do it right. You know, it's interesting that in what we do, so many times we go in and somebody in marketing or somebody in the C-level had an idea and they say, go with it. And there's no thought put to it. And it's this top-down mentality inside a corporate culture that when John, the CEO, says, okay, Betty, I need your marketing department to get this done for me, Betty goes and does it without questioning or thinking. And I shouldn't say that. There is pushback inside boardrooms. I've been there. I've seen that. But the corporate culture is much more, I can go in and be very blunt because I don't know the personal politics between people in the office. And I can point out areas where there's problems or areas where there's room for growth much easier because I don't have to worry about the corporate politic. And that allows us to be much freer. Now, you ask about faults or things that I struggle with. I tend to be a bull in a china shop sometimes because the product that we sell, Richard, it's creativity. It's intangible. You just don't make it, right? We sell ideas. Another thing that's intangible, and everybody's got their own ideas. But at the end of the day, somebody has to be in the position to make the decision, to make the decision to do the right things. So we're always putting the best foot forward. And if you can get out of the egos of people, hard to do, and move forward and move. My whole thing is that I like to pivot fast. I don't like to stick with something forever and say, this is the path. This is what we're going to do forever. From this day forward, this is exactly how we're going to do it. Because things change. And large corporations in particular, you know, we're a speedboat. Or we can get out through all the bay and move all around, right? We're not set for the big ocean, but we can pivot very quickly with inside the bay. But the big ships, the big ad agencies, they're oil tankers. And even in the bay, they can't move quickly. And so that's the way that we're structured has changed everything because it allows us to make decisions quickly, move off of them quickly. And when clients aren't capable of doing that, especially with large campaigns, we've seen a problem. Bud Light is a perfect example. There's nobody in the room saying, hey guys, I know that in the bubble that you're in, you all think this is a great idea, but outside the bubble, have you tested this with the audience that you're working with? Nobody did that. There was no audience testing of the Bud Light decision. And so it cost them billions. Again, that's what we do. I know it's a great idea. I know you want to be progressive and move forward. We're all with you. But what impact is this going to have on your end user? And with Bud Light, it was a huge one.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to talk then about the common enemy in the advertising space, right? And so every superhero has an arch nemesis, the things that they constantly have to fight against in their world. And so in the world of business, we like to put it in the context of your clients. And it's a mindset or a flaw that they come to you with that actually prevents you from getting the result that they came to you for. And so in your world, what is the common enemy that you regularly have to fight against as you bring on new clients?
Knowledge, lack of knowledge on how fast things actually happen, what it takes to get something ramped up from the beginning to the end. Those are probably the two biggest ones. People that just don't understand, thinking that you can put together a 200-page website in a week or two. You can build the infrastructure. You can, but you can't do it all. We had a client in Florida here recently that we had built 30 websites for. It was for a specific kind of project. And so we'd built 30 different websites. They were all interlinked. The client didn't see any of that happening and was upset because we were never in the office. We didn't call them. We didn't check in with them weekly. We talked to their marketing department, but I don't call the CEO. Even though I'm the director of my company, I'm busy all day long. And to call you and to have a conversation with you and just check in and say, hey, listen, we're still working on this stuff. We still got it, right? Their marketing department knew what was going on, but the CEO said that he felt abandoned, that we got our check and then he didn't hear from me anymore. And so I called him and I said, are we supposed to be friends or are we working for you? If you wanted somebody to talk to you, just call me. If you want somebody to call, I'll talk to you all day long, but I got other things to do while we're talking.
Yeah,
and that's hard for some people to hear because they want that attention. right? They're paying us $100,000, $200,000 for a project. Some people want that attention. That's not generally the way that we work. Again, I'm efficient. So when spending 30 minutes, 40 minutes talking about where we are in the process doesn't make any sense. Because what we're going to do, the process for us, is that we do all this work. We've got our instructions. We're working with your team. We supply that information. Here you go. And then there's the revision process. And for people who want to go through and revise the project as we're moving along is slow and arduous, and it costs more money. And I tell them up front, we're very good on keeping things in scope, right? The website or the TV commercial or the radio spot or the billboard has to have these parameters met. That's what we agreed to. That's what we're doing. And then the client comes in and says, well, can you change this or can you change that? And some things are easy, right? Can you change the color of the font? Yeah, we can do that. Yeah, that's easy. That's an easy one. Can you rearrange all of these edits? I don't like this particular edit here because there's a sun flare that comes in. Or this is my favorite. I showed the preview ads to my sister who's in college doing this, and she thinks, then hire her. That's the thing I'm challenged by most.
Yeah.
Is you know, this information of, well, my son said, well, then hire your son. I don't know what to tell you. If he was at the level that we are, you'd call him. Why didn't you call him? And that's generally that's not the first conversation that I have. But there's a point where we get to with these problem clients. And of course, we're talking about problem clients, right? We're not talking about every client. These are the hurdles that we face. The industry as a whole, I think today that the industry, one of the problems that the industry has, that its main nemesis is that we have, I'm probably step on some toes here, we have a ton of inexperienced kids making huge decisions for brands, and they haven't lived life long enough to have the experiences to be able to say that's the wrong decision to make. And then the hubris of them not being willing to abandon what they've put their fingerprint on because of how to look. We don't care about any of that. At Mosaic, we come in, our job is, and I say it all the time in pitches, the only reason I'm here is to help you make enough money to pay me a lot of money. That's the only reason I'm here. I'm gonna help you clean up your brand, right? But that's the bull in the china shop mentality. And we get to that by saying, this is our track record. Here's who we've worked with before. Here's what we've been able to do before. And if you don't want to work inside that structure, I get it. There's other groups out there. You don't have to hire us. But once you hire us, this is the way we work because we find it works best, not just for us, but for the clients. And to the CEO who, I can't remember the name of the book. I read it when I was a kid, but it was about being efficient. And so I found the book and I directed him towards it. And I said, this is the basis of what I believe. And he goes, okay, so he read it, no more problems. And in fact, he started doing the same thing with his life, that his meetings, for example, he was kind of freeform. He would walk into your office and have a conversation with you. And before you know it, you'd blown an hour and a half. Nothing got done. Nothing was decided. It was a wasted time. And he says, as soon as I stopped leaving my office for anything other than a mission, something that I had to get taken care of, he goes, all of a sudden I found out I had all this time left in my day. Oh, I know. And if you get time, if you're smart, you turn that into cash. That's kind of my mentality.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know I've dealt with a lot of the same things in our agency. You know, the problem clients for us is like, you know, we tell you, here's the things you should do with your podcast. And they're like, well, we like those things, but we're going to do these things instead. And then, you know, they'll go back and change all these things. And then 3 months later, they'll end up back where we told them to start. And he was like,
it is what it is, right? You know, Richard, when I liken it to a plumber or an electrician. There's certain things that I know with inside those fields. I'm a much better electrician than I am a plumber. I hate plumbing. I hate plastering. I hate that. Because there's a skill set, the 10,000 hour rule, right? You get really good at something after 10,000 hours of doing it. I watched a guy the other day on TikTok cutting a chicken. And he was cutting a chicken up, you know, to serve or to get ready to cook. And the speed at which this guy did this, I would have cut off all my fingers. But he was so efficient in deboning that chicken and stripping the meat off and getting the most efficiency out of that chicken. And I'm thinking to myself, this is the way I look at things. I wish we could do that with everybody. And can I do a chicken? Yeah, I can do a chicken. I can't do it as good as he does. And so that efficiency that he got from doing it for 10,000 hours or more, sitting there every day doing that and going through that to prep that chicken. Well, Richard, it's the same thing as you knowing how to make a podcast work. That's what it really, when it really comes down to brass tacks, do you want somebody there that can talk a big game or actually do the work? And do you want somebody that is going to come in and tell you, my sister thinks this should look this way, as opposed to this way, when if it's arbitrary, I don't care, right? I don't care if it's arbitrary, right? We want to use this kind of font instead of this kind of font. We look at it and go, that doesn't make a difference, right? If they want to use this color over that color, nah, I don't care. They want to, you know, whatever that part of it, I don't care about. But when it comes to messaging, when it comes to the look of it, when it comes to, as I said before, putting too much information in, you know, McDonald's, I go back to the brand. This is where I take my clients. Listen, don't trust me. You've paid me a lot of money, but you don't have to trust me. Let's look at the other brands around the world that I haven't worked for that are doing these things and are highly successful. They're highly successful because they work. As I said, I'm lazy. I don't want to create something else completely new, Richard, from the get-go. That's not efficient. When I look at what McDonald's has done or what Nike has done or what Panasonic has done or NASCAR has done, there's certain elements that we can take out of every one of their brand growth stories and be able to look at that and say, okay, what's the best part that they have there? And then that's what as professionals, we go, that works. And we can prove it by doing it over and over again. So we don't have, McDonald's doesn't have a billboard that shows everything that's on their menu.
Yeah. Because
they show their hottest sellers. And that's what we try to get, you know, companies and marketing directors to understand that I know that you want the logo bigger. I want the logo bigger. Logo doesn't matter here. That's one of the biggest complaints we have with companies that on their websites. Can you make the logo bigger? No, they don't. You don't need a bigger logo. Well, why not? We want them to know who we are. They're at your front door. They know who you are. They've arrived on your front doorstep. You don't need your address, you know, plastered across the front of the house when you've got it on the mailbox. It doesn't need to be there. And so it's these little things of explaining why, you know, these are the hassles that we go through. And you've got a CEO that this happens a lot. We're dealing with the marketing department. We never see the C-level. And so somebody in the C-level makes a decision. And eventually I got to get in the mix and go, listen, guys, we're out of scope. You're changing these things. We agreed to these 6 weeks ago. Now we'll change them. I don't have a problem changing them, but it's going to cost you to do that.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed how many times, Richard, the decision is, well, how much is it going to cost? Well, if we go back through and take all these videos and revise what you want to revise, it's going to cost $10,000, $15,000. Still want to do it? No? Okay. And that's what changes it, right? Because when we put a cash value to it, now some times clients go, yeah, that's what I want. I go, okay, I'm fine with that because we get paid for it, right? I'm going to be adamant. If it's something that I don't believe that you should do, I'm that guy. I will go to the mat for it because it's the right thing to do. And I guess in today's environment, when you've got a strong opinion and you air it strongly, some people take that as aggression or hate. Nope, I keep telling people, the only reason I'm here to make money, I don't want to prove anything else. What we do in the advertising industry, unlike movies and unlike music, this art form that we have, we call advertising, it's waning. And what I mean by that is that I create an ad today that is huge. Nobody is playing that ad in their car 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 20 years from now. It's not like music. It's not like a movie, right? The ad played, it served its purpose, and it's gone. But some people they look at the art that we create as something that has to be permanent. No, it's for the moment. We move on to the next thing. And so to your point about perfection, early on in my career, that was a big one. I really struggled with that one. It's got to be perfect when it goes out the door. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It's never perfect, ever. And yeah. I had a boss told me one time, he goes, you like to make fairies dance on the head of a pin. Well, regardless of how many fairies you got going, Kramer, at some point it's got to hit the air. And that really changed my mindset. At some point it's got to hit the air. And he was right. I was spending, you know, countless hours on this a second and a quarter part of a radio spot because I didn't like how the music faded in and out. So I'm doing it over and over and over again. And he's looking at the clock going, this is going on the air at 2 o'clock and it's 1:58, right? So that part of it is also important, is to keep clients' mindset is that we're going to produce the very best we can in the time that we have available and with the budget that we have available, produce the very best. But at some point, regardless of how good or bad you think it is, for it to be effective, it has to go into the marketplace. And so what that does is that I'm real cognizant of that. We've never missed a deadline with any client, ever. Not one. Mosaic has never missed a deadline because what the clients have, but we haven't. So the client changes. Well, we want to make this change late in the game. Okay, well, we can do that. But that pushes the start date out now a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever. And it is what it is at that point. But we're very adamant that our job is not to come in and try to change the culture of the company. It's not to try to change you as a marketing director to look at things a different way, per se. It's to make money. That's all it is. And people, I was told, that's crass. Well, it's the truth.
Yeah.
Right? That's why I'm here. If you didn't pay me, I wouldn't be here. I don't care about your advertising problems if I'm not being compensated. Couldn't care less. And by talking that crass to clients, I think they understand that we're invested with them. And that's why in the almost 30 years that the company has been in existence, over that period, we've only lost two or three clients. I'll give the third one. Because up front, this is the way I sell. This is the way I pitch. And I say that our job is to make sure that you don't have the hassle of having to worry about the issues that we're here to solve. That's why I don't call the CEO. That's why I don't have those little, hey, catch up freight. That's inefficient, right?
Yeah.
Give us the autonomy to go out and be great with you. We work great with your teams. We integrate well. And again, because of how we're structured, if we get into a position to where we need new services, whatever that may be, for example, creating an app for Panasonic that allowed them to talk directly to a satellite. They needed to upload information from this app when it got finished, all the data in this app, it was a questionnaire. When it got done, it compiled everything and sent it up via a satellite. On a semi-truck. I'd never done that before. I'd never been in that process before. Neither had the CEO of the company or anybody that we're working with in the marketing department at Just Marketing in Atlanta or with Panasonic. And so the process that we went through in that deal is that they gave us autonomy. So we were able to go out and make some mistakes before we ever presented to the client, right? We found out what didn't work real fast, because what we do is, to your point, well, we'll work 48 hours, 72 hours straight, stay up for days, right? Because we love what we do. And so that investment, we don't see as a bad one until you're trying to play catch up, you know, with sleep and so on over the weekend. But that approach, Richard, has allowed us to go in and do some amazing things for clients, because we don't look at things the way that they are. We look at them the way that they could be. And how much money can we make doing it that way? How much money can we make for the client, right? And that's what I've always said, is that, to your point, our business is structured a little bit differently, is that we had our very first client. We had rates that were already set. Client comes in and says, well, I'm not paying those rates. I was like, well, why not? Well, that's standard rates. We're not going to pay that. If you don't work with us, these are the rates that we'll pay. And I said, okay, I took it. It was my first client. Within a year to 2 years, we were up at the rates that we needed to be at. But what it gave us is that period to get in bed with them and for them to realize who we were and how we worked, and that we really were an in-house department that they didn't have in-house. We thought about them on a daily basis, right? We would say, hey, listen, there was an automobile group. So he owned several dealerships around the country. And we started looking at keeping in line with what Ford was delivering in all of their memos. So we read all of the Ford memos. So we knew what plans were coming up. We knew in tandem. The client didn't have to tell us. We got access to that material and we started reading it ourselves so that we could come up with ideas and concepts on how to market before the client even knew that there was an issue. And so again, that you have to be, I think, very blunt up front and prove your point time and time again, prove how good you are. And then they finally go, okay, they're not going to harm us. They're on our side. They're working with us. They understand our culture, and they hit time and time again. To have a client like that, I don't know if you know anything about the auto industry, but car dealers, especially group owners, are some of the cheap, probably isn't the word to use, but that comes to mind first. They're operating at very thin margins. And so what they want to do is get the cost down of everything that they do as low as possible. And so when you've got an auto dealer that is working with you over a 30-year period, that says something about the relationship of what we've been able to deliver. And the day that he called and told me, listen, we got to stop, right? They haven't advertised in 2 years. That's how bad the economy went for the auto industry. And they decided just not to advertise. They're a huge dealer. So they've got to pull a brand awareness. They just went to digital, and they do that through Ford now. They don't need an outsider. So it changed the dynamics of what was needed. But I still get calls from both the owner and the marketing director for other projects that are outside of the dealership.
It just shows what it does when you actually show up and work with integrity over the course of time. You know, that's how you have a company that lasts 30 years, right? Where most companies never make it past year one or year five.
Right. That's the hardest hurdle, right? Is proving to people that you'll do it time and time again. And Richard, that comes back down to brand, right?
Yeah.
is that my clients, that's what they got to expect. And they knew that we delivered it for them. And so they didn't have any problems. We, in this 30-year period, we've only had one salesperson in 30 years. One.
That's impressive.
That salesperson, no longer with us, but the company's reputation is what carries us forward. So 9 out of 10 of our clients come through a recommendation from a former client or current client. And they've got a buddy. And they'll be on the golf course or having drinks at a cocktail party and say, I've got this problem with this. And they'll say, I've got a buddy. And that's how we look at ourselves. Richard, we are not the first chosen ever. We're chosen second a lot. And the reason we're chosen for second is because the first company that went in made a lot of promises and didn't deliver. I'll give you one more example of that. Went in to pitch on a job and we were the last to pitch. And I had an inside track on what was going on. The CFO or the CEO, he was the chief engineering officer, not executive officer, but the CEO lived next door to me. And he wanted me on the project, but he didn't have any say. And so he pulled us in and we got to be the last people there at the meeting. He didn't tell me anything about what they were talking about. We didn't have any private information from the previous vendors of what they had promised and so on. But as we talked about what their needs were, I said, well, what's their timeline? I said, you're probably looking at what, a 10 week to 15 week or 16 week turnaround on this. And they go, yeah, so we can have it done in 7 days. We can have it all done. Everything that you're asking for, we can have it done in 7 days because we don't need to go through the discovery phase. And he goes, well, how do I know you're telling me the truth? How do I know that you're not going to, you know, jump in here and make all these promises and then not deliver on them? I says, well, there's one way to find out. You'll know in 7 days. These other groups, you won't know for 10 to 16 weeks. With us, you'll know in 7 days. And so he went to Mexico on a corporate trip. They owned a company down in Mexico. And from Mexico, I get a phone call from him. Well, we've decided to go with you. Can we get that? Will it still be done by this date? Well, 2 days had passed. And I said, nope, 7 days. We'll have it done in 7 days. You're now at 5. We'll have it done in 7. And he goes, okay. And he says, contract's already been signed. Go over and pick up the check. Went over and picked up the check to get started. And they had it done in 5 days. So, you know, delivering on what you promise is huge for me. Meeting those timelines is huge for me. The product that we sell is time. That's all we sell. We don't sell anything else. So I was talking earlier about, you know, we sell creativity. But what we really sell is we sell time.
Yeah.
And you don't get any more of that. There's only so much. And so I'm real efficient with the time for the client. My time is a different thing. I'm terrible with my time. But for clients, I'm great at it because I can break down, you know, this is what it's going to take to get it done. This is how much budget we have available for it. And I'm real keen to not stepping over that. And I think a lot of agencies, well, not just a lot of agencies, a lot of companies, and I think the reason they don't survive is because they bend over backwards for their clients so much that it costs them. To your point, physically, with, you know, not sleeping, working their butt off, is they get to the point sometimes where they feel that they're being taken advantage of. Well, they allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
The client didn't do that. You allowed that to happen. And if they ask for something out of scope or over the bounds of what you've agreed to, then you've got to have the backbone to say, nope, that's out of scope. We can do it. We'd love to do it for you, but it's going to be additional dollars or additional time, right? One of the books I read, again, when I was a kid, was a book called Negotiate to Win. And the guy in the book says, all answers can be maybe. Right. And which was really important for me to because we want to think of binary, right? Yes or no. But he calls it the Japanese no. The Japanese no is a yes with a caveat. And oh, yes, we can do that. But you're going to have to do this or we're going to have to do this. And it was a different way of thinking about things. And again, this is the kind of reading I was doing as a kid. So you can imagine, you know, the way I look at the world now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because we're learning a lot of those things as our agency grows. Is like, hey, we have to be really clear up front with what our scope is. So when they do ask for changes, because I always inevitably come that like, okay, that like we've already thought about that. You're like, sure, you can have that, but here's what that costs and what it does to the time frame and whatnot. And you know, those are, I guess, younger.
Well, and you're going through your process, Richard. I imagine that when you're talking to your client, you show them, you know, here's this plan, but here's what's also available. Or they want to go down a path and you walk them down the path of, well, you don't want to do that, or you want to do it this way for specific reasons because you know what works and doesn't work, right? It's the difference between winning and losing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of heroic tools, I want to take a few minutes to tell you about a tool we built that powers the Hero Show and is now this show's primary sponsor. Hey there, fellow podcaster. Having a weekly audio and video show on all the major online networks that builds your brand, creates fame, and drives sales for your business doesn't have to be hard. I know it feels that way because you've tried managing your show internally and realize how resource intensive it can be. You felt the pain of pouring 8 to 10 hours of work into just getting 1 hour of content published and promoted all over the place. You see the drain on your resources, but you do it anyways because you know how powerful it is. Heck, you've probably even tried some of those automated solutions and ended up with stuff that makes your brand look cheesy and cheap. That's not helping grow your business. Don't give up though. The struggle ends now. Introducing Push Button Podcasts, a done-for-you service that will help you get your show out every single week without you lifting a finger after you've pushed that stop record button. We handle everything else: uploading, editing, transcribing, writing, research, graphics, publication, and promotion, all done by real humans who know, understand, and care about your brand almost as much as you do. Empowered by our own proprietary technology, our team will let you get back to doing what you love while we handle the rest. Check us out at pushbuttonpodcast.com/hero for 10% off the lifetime of your service with us, and see the power of having an audio and video podcast growing and driving micro-celebrity status and business in your niche without you having to lift more than a finger to push that stop record button. Again, that's pushbuttonpodcast.com/hero. See you there. And now, back to the Hero Show.
So I got one more question I want to ask you, and it's about your guiding principles, right? So one of the things that makes heroes heroic is that they live by a code. For instance, Batman never kills his enemies. He only ever puts him in Arkham Asylum. So as we wrap up the interview, I want to talk about the top one, maybe two principles that you run your company by, that you live your life by. Maybe something you wish you'd known when you first started your company 30 years ago.
I would say that one of the most important things I learned, and I learned it early on, but it was not to react to what you think someone else thinks. They haven't said anything, but you perceive something, and so you take it in a certain way, whatever that is, without ever clarifying. And I think that far too many people in all industries do that, is that they may see it as a slight, or they may see somebody made, I'll give you an example. A girl that I dated years ago, we'd seen another girl out, and I thought, oh my God, I love her hairdo. The girl that I was dating at the time was tall. She's taller than me. She was 6'1". And she went out and got her hair cut the exact same way this other girl got her hair cut, because I said I liked it. And she goes, I said I liked it on her, but she's like 5'4". And it was a pixie haircut, right? A little real close to the, and I said, you're 6'1". You can't have a pixie haircut. It doesn't look right on you. You look like a Q-tip. You know, of course, she took it the wrong way.
It's constructive criticism from my point. Probably not the best that I've ever done.
But that thing, that right there, I think, is one of the hardest parts to overcome, if I understand the question correctly, is that people's perceptions sometimes leak over into their actions, and those actions are based on a fallacy. Now, we see it a lot in politics. We see it a lot in relationships, even in marriages, that people don't talk out enough of what they need to talk out to get clarification. So when we go into a client, the first thing that we do, Richard, is I want to know what their goal is. You know, it's not just enough for me to be there and create something. I want to find out why they're doing it. What's the purpose for it? What is it supposed to work on? What is it supposed to deliver? And in doing that, we can be much better at what we do. So communication is key. Clarification is key. I'm a real big user of words. You know, we write on it. I write. It's one of the things I hated in school. I hated English. And now writing is probably 90% of what I do, is coming up with concepts and phrasing them so people understand them. And the hurdle that I have.
We call that unmet expectations, right? 90% of attention comes from unmet expectations, or uncommunicated unmet expectations. And
right.
So when you are talking, whether it's clients or your girlfriend or your kids or whatever, there's always the expectation in your head and the expectation that they know. Right. And unless things line up, and yourself up for contention in the future.
And that's it. Dave, yeah. You know, in marriages, a lot of times it's the toilet seat issue, right? The toilet seat up or down. And so I thought you were going to do this, or I thought this had been done, or I thought that's one of the things that I thought, or I perceived, all right? That part of it, why didn't you ask? Why didn't you just clarify it? Why didn't you? Because now we've wasted time and energy. And so those things are probably the biggest hurdles that we go through. I think in the future, we've got some real tough issues to address here in the nation. I think there's some big issues for the world to address that's happening. And it affects advertising. People don't believe that what's happening politically affects it, but it does. And so we've got so many things going on right now. I think that getting clarification and not acting on just our gut feeling would get us a long way, I think, is the best way to put it.
And I agree with you. I think expectations are huge. Setting clear expectations is a huge principle for people to follow in their business. I do think that's a great place for us to wrap our interview. We just crossed over our timeline there. One more question for you. I always finish all of my interviews with something I call the Heroes Challenge. And it's simple. What we do is we're looking to get access to stories we might not otherwise find on our own, because not everyone's out doing the podcast rounds like you or I might do. So the question is, do you have someone in your life or in your network that you think has a cool entrepreneurial story? And I think probably with 30 years of business behind you, you probably know a lot. Who's the first person that would come to mind for you for wanting to come share their story here on the Hero Show?
I probably a couple of them. I've got one, a guy named Adam Ritz, guy I worked with in radio. He was my sales guy. He came over and he's a great salesperson, but it wasn't for him. And he started a company called Vibonomics. They deliver audio commercial-based music into stores. So in the Midwest here, it's Kroger is one of their big clients. But what they do is they delivered a system to where he created radio stations specifically for stores, and it's all served up digitally. It's a cool concept. But on the side, this is a completely different story. He launched, as a passion project, he loves yacht rock music. Are you familiar with yacht rock? Okay, it's Fleetwood Mac. It's all that AM pop stuff from the 70s, right? All the way up to like 79, 80. Stuff from the 80s really didn't make it in, but it's all that older stuff. And he started this program to where he put together a radio program about this music. And then he went out and started interviewing all these old stars. So he would talk to people from Peebo Bryson, right? Or not Peebo Bryson. I'm trying to think of who he would talk to in that group. It didn't matter. But these older groups. And he created this radio program, and it's now been nationally syndicated. So he does the same thing that I do. He finds things that he's passionate about. I'm interested in this area. And then he finds out a way to make money at it. And so he likes these artists. He likes their music. He found a way of getting involved in that. And so he produces I think it's a 2-hour show a week that stations around the nation air. And it's just yacht rock music and his interviews of the artists from that period. But cool story.
Yeah, we'll reach out later and see if we can get an introduction to him. Maybe we can get him on this. But in comic books, there's always the crowd of people at the end who are cheering and clapping for the act of heroism. Our analogous to that here on this show is we want to know, where can people find Mosaic? And, light up the bat signal and say, hey, Tim, we would love to get your help. And I think more importantly than where is, who are the right types of companies to reach out and ask for your assistance?
The right clients, we have found that startups are great. We work great with startups. The client base that we usually work with, if it's a regional client, they have to be generating somewhere in the ballparks of $25 to $30 million a year minimum to be able to do the campaigns that we generally work on. We work with smaller clients, but not typically, because of the problems that you have. Generally, their teams aren't large enough, right? They can't absorb a group like ours coming in if they've only got one person working on marketing. So that's probably the best fit is regional manufacturing. We do a lot of B2C, business to consumer, but we also do a lot of B2B political candidates. If you're a conservative political candidate or cause, we do a lot of work nationally with that as well on the conservative side. You can find us at choosemosaic.com. That's choosemosaic.com. And you can learn more about me by going to LinkedIn and you just search for Tim Cramer or
awesome.
Mosaic.
Thank you so much for coming on today, Tim. Really appreciated getting to hear your thoughts and your stories and what it is that you've been doing, especially running a successful company for 30 plus years. That is a huge feat that not a lot of companies make it to. So I appreciate that. And I know we didn't talk a lot about it, but you also do some political commentary and you're on the news regularly. So your voice that is heard around the nation regularly. So I appreciate your time coming on the show and just sharing your story today. Do you have any final words of wisdom for our audience before we hit the stop record button?
Expect more. Expect more. Whatever you're doing, expect more, want more. Be happy with what you have, but expect more. I was asked recently, are you happy? And I said, yes, I'm happy. I've got a great life. Not satisfied, but I'm happy.
I call that contented ambition.
That's
content.
It right there.
Got ambition. Yep. Awesome. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Hero Show, where we work to shift the cultural narrative around entrepreneurship and celebrate the heropreneurs who make our world a better place. Don't forget to visit our website at theheroshow.tv. where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. If you found value in our show, we'd truly appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or better yet, share it with a friend to help us spread the message of entrepreneurship as a force for good. Curious to learn more about the stories and insights of these incredible heropreneurs? Check out our in-depth interviews and resources on our website. Together, let's support and inspire the next generation of entrepreneurs as they embark on their own heroic journeys. Join us again next week for another episode of The Hero Show, where we'll continue to explore the world of heropreneurs, their superpowers, and the positive impact they bring to our lives. Until then, stay heroic.